The prophet Micah lived and prophesied, wrote in the 8th century BC. And that century was one of much prophetic activity. It was the century of Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Jonah, and Micah living in the final third of the 8th and at the very beginning of the 7th century. Now, he must be among the least studied prophets in the church era, except that part of his book, which was 1,000 years ago, designated as chapter 4, that has become of great interest in the past half century as Christendom awakens to the coming reality of the end times and Armageddon. Yet he was much read and taken seriously by the kings of Judah and Ephraim Israel in his day, and was revered enough that the later prophet Jeremiah even quoted him. Now, in that era, the united Israel of David and Solomon had long ago disappeared to be replaced by two separate kingdoms, one called Judah, the other called Ephraim or Ephraim Israel. And these kingdoms, though recognizing their common heritage, were so separate that they warred with each other off and on, were generally thought of by their neighbors as unassociated countries. And due to the direction and influence of Jeroboam, the first king of Ephraim Israel, upon united Israel's dissolution, the ancient Hebrew faith of the patriarchs that each country practiced had strongly diverged. The Jerusalem-centered faith of the Torah remained only for Judah. Ephraim Israel had established its own temple and priesthood based in the city of Samaria. King Jeroboam eventually went so far as to essentially prohibit the people of Ephraim to travel to the Jerusalem temple for holy observances. He even erected a golden calf as a representation of Yahweh, and much worship was directed towards it. Now, the name Micah means "who is like Yahweh." He gets confused with another prophet of a similar name, Micaiah ben Imlah. Now, where an extended name for our prophet is used, it is Micha of Moresheth, or Micha of Moresheth Gat, because there was more than one town called Moresheth. Now, his hometown was located around 20 miles southwest of Jerusalem, in a region called the Shephelah, the coastal plain. And we read of Micaiah ben Imlah in the book of 1 Kings as a prophet who prophesied about a century prior to our Micah and was a prophet to the kingdom of Ephraim Israel. Now, there's a few similarities between the two prophets, but the differences in writing and style are so significant that it is too much to entertain the idea that these were the same person, even though some scholars still maintain that they are one and the same. Micah was a Judean, although he had much to say about the northern kingdom of Ephraim, or for the sake of brevity, most times I'll refer to the northern kingdom of Ephraim Israel as just Ephraim. Now, the kings of Judah that he served under were Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Now, quite a number of short-lived kings ruled over Ephraim during the same time, each king murdered by the succeeding one. Now, this, of course, led to massive instability of Ephraim, making it ripe for being overtaken by the unquestioned regional power of that era, Assyria. Now, when Micah speaks about Ephraim, it's mostly about its coming destruction and the fall of its capital city, Samaria, which finally occurred during the years of 723 to 721 BC. So Micah, like Isaiah, lived during the time of world-shaking events that largely followed the flow of the growing imperial ambitions of the Assyrian kings. Now, without getting too specific, we can rightly say that the Middle East saw the close of one era and the beginning of a new upon the death of King Uzziah of Judah in 740 BC. What leads up to, during, and immediately following such great transitions and changes in geopolitics and world order are messy and chaotic. Much territory changed hands in the 8th century. Formerly sovereign nations suddenly became vassal states of Assyria, Ammon, Moab, Edom, Philistia, and then Ephraim were included. Judah paid much tribute to Assyria to remain a little more independent for a time, but eventually they too became totally dominated. Now, when empires like Assyria's overtakes nations and regions, they bring with them their culture, religion, religious institutions. And that had much to do with accelerating Ephraim's already corrupted faith, and began to greatly affect Judah's, although not quite as significantly as Ephraim. And it was the thorough corruption of Ephraim's faith and faith institutions that led to God directing Assyria to conquer them as punishment, to scatter the 10 tribes of Ephraim, Israel, to the wind, to the point that they eventually were given the unofficial moniker of the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Now, I find it helpful to put such events as this into their historical context of what was going on elsewhere in the world. And during Micah's era, Greece was in a period of transformation, exiting their own dark ages. It was now when the Grecian system of city-states began. That is, large cities became their own states with their own kings. This polis system, as it was called, became the main structure of Greek government and expansion. They expanded by colonizing all along the Mediterranean and Black Seas. This was the same time frame in which the renowned Greek poet Homer wrote, and when the Olympic Games were first established. In the same century, the city of Rome was founded by Romulus. In northern Africa, the kingdom of Kush was on the rise and soon would dominate Egypt. India was in transition, led by its religious leadership, which would go on to shape the philosophical foundations of ancient India. See, the picture we need to see is of a dynamic world, and most of it in a time of great transitions that would forever alter their trajectory. What was going on with Judah, Ephraim, and the Middle East was indicative and representative of the state of the known world of the 8th century BC, not at all unique to it. See, it's no wonder that we find so many biblical prophets sent by God to his people to warn and correct and direct during that century. Although it might not appear so, even 2,800 years ago, the world was connected enough that a rebellion in one place could give rise to a rebellion in another. Ideas spread rapidly, as did moods and aspirations. Now, the most complete book of Micah text that we have in Hebrew is the Masoretic text. The oldest complete Bible among the several texts scribed by the Masoretes is the Leningrad Codex from 1000 AD. The oldest fragment of Micah is from the Dead Sea Scrolls from the 2nd century BC. And what little we do have of it matches very well with the Masoretic text. So we can confidently assume that what we have today in the Bible versions that are based on the Hebrew Masoretic texts versus being based on the Greek Septuagint, it's authentically very close to the original. Now, that said, there are other copies of it in other languages. We have it in the Greek Septuagint in what's called Old Greek, also the Aramaic Targum, the Syriac Peshitta, the Latin Vulgate. There are variances within the Micah text among all these, although not so serious as to invalidate any of them. You know, anytime a translation from the original language to a different language occurs, a very natural redaction happens because every language is wed to the culture from which it came. So it can be difficult at best to sometimes bring across important nuances of meaning from one language to the next. Many more times than I'm comfortable with, educated guesses must be used. Now, Bible scholars and teachers usually prefer to divide Bible books into sections that they see as forming the literary structure of any particular book. Then they assign names to these sections. Nothing wrong with that, as long as we don't adhere to it too rigidly, since these are man-made divisions, just created mostly for the sake of establishing some logical, systematic means of study. I'm not sure one system's any better than another. So I'll just sort of outline the book as a way to approach it. Micah consists of 7 chapters, the contents of which are generally as follows. Chapter 1, the idolatry of Samaria and Jerusalem are denounced. The prophet laments their coming fall and exhorts the people to mourning, to prepare for what is soon to happen. Chapter 2, denunciation and oppression of oppression and worship corruption, along with this prediction of the punishment of God's people on account of it. The eventual restoration of Israel is also foretold. Chapter 3, the prophet rebukes first the leaders for their cruelty, then the false prophets who lie for money as the primary causes of all the evil that has overtaken the Israelites. He continues to reprove the leaders for their oppression, which he says will cause the ruin even of Jerusalem. Chapter 4, in poetical language, Micah speaks of the restoration of Jerusalem and the returned glory of the house of Yahweh. A latter day's victory of Israel over the nations is foretold. Chapter 5, a prediction that a powerful king of Judah will vanquish the Gentile nations, particularly Assyria, and will destroy idolatry among God's people. Chapter 6, all Israel is reproved for its sins, particularly its injustice. For this injustice, punishments prophesied. Chapter 7, the lack of righteous men and the corruption of Israel are lamented. the prophet comforts Israel, promising that it will, in the future, be restored to its land and will triumph over its enemies. Now, for the sake of using simple labels as we go along in our study, I think Anderson's and Friedman's way of dividing up Micah into but three sections is the most helpful. They call chapters 1-3 the Book of Doom, chapters 4 and 5 the Book of Visions, chapters 6 and 7 the Book of Contention and Conciliation. Now, although the words aren't that challenge on the surface, nonetheless, Micah's style of writing has caused a wide scope of differences as how to understand and translate large sections of it. See, it boils down to this. As opposed to Isaiah, for example, who goes to great lengths to explain himself in quite complete ways, Micah is the opposite. Micah is abrupt, rough, speaks almost a kind of shorthand. Prepositions are often left out. Verb genders don't always match with their objects. Subjects suddenly change in mid-sentence. He employs plays on wordplay, some of which are only recently being discovered and better understood. He switches quickly from symbolism to simile to literal narrative. He mixes poetry with narrative. So, as happens regularly in Hebrew poetry, hyperbole elevates the tension in his statements. Sometimes it's difficult to tell if it's Micah speaking his own words or if he's simply relating God's words. Although I think literary and text critics make far too much of that factor. Because as a prophet, the message given is always assumed to be God's, whether or not it comes from the prophet's own mind or from the word-for-word oracle divinely given to him. Now, the other result of scholarly criticisms of the book is that they think many words have been wrongly transmitted through copyist errors, editorial redactions over the centuries, even words or phrases entirely omitted. So this group of commentators and academics prefers to virtually rewrite sentences, reorder them, or to display what they think ought to appear. Some of this comes from a rigid Western academic way of assuming that the Bible ought to be structured the way they would have done it, or that the biblical writers were all following some common intellectual grammatical protocol, and so it should be consistent among all the books. Then if we don't find it that way, what we're seeing are errors in transmission or textual corruption. Now, naturally, since the Bible was hand-copied until the invention of the printing press a little over 500 years ago, there would always be some minor errors introduced, many of which aren't terribly hard to identify. However, the level of change that some Bible scholars proposed to Micah's book isn't warranted. Those ancient literary protocols did not exist in reality in any formal form that has ever been found. And besides, over the centuries, not only styles, but the nuanced meaning of words evolved. The bottom line, for the most part, I'm going to leave Micah alone and take it as we find it. Although, at times, I might offer an alternative to consider if I think it warrants it. And finally, in the Hebrew Bible, Micah is the 6th in the order of the 12 minor prophets. Who these 12 are and what order they appear seems to be original, and unchanged, as no other prophets, no other order of books, their books in the Hebrew language has ever been found. With that as a backdrop, let's open up Micah chapter 1. This is the word of Adonai that came to Micha, the Morshiti, during the days of Yotam, Yachaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Shomron and Yerushalayim. Listen, peoples, all of you, pay attention, earth and everything in it. Adonai Elohim will witness against you, Adonai from his holy temple, for look, Adonai is coming out of his place, coming down to tread on the high places of the land. Beneath him, the mountains will melt, the valleys split open like wax before fire, like water poured down a steep slope. All this is because of the crime of Yaakov, the sins of the house of Israel. What is the crime of Yaakov? Isn't it Shomron? What are the high places of Judah? Aren't they Yerushalayim? So I will make Shomron a heap in the countryside, a place for planting vineyards. I will pour her stones down into the valley, laying bare her foundations. All her carved images will be smashed to pieces, all she earned consumed by fire. I will reduce her idols to rubble. She amassed them from a whore's wages, and as a whore's wages, they will be spent again. This is why I howl and wail, why I go barefoot and stripped, why I howl like the jackals, mourn like the ostriches. For her wound cannot be healed. Now it's coming to Judah as well. It reaches even to the gate of my people, to Jerusalem itself. Don't tell about it in Gath. Don't shed any tears. At Beit La'afra, roll yourself in the dust. Inhabitants of Shephir, pass on your way in nakedness and shame. The inhabitants of Zanaan have not left yet. The wailing of Bet Ha'atzel will remove from you their support. The inhabitants of Marot have no hope of anything good. For Adonai has sent down disaster to the very gate of Jerusalem. Harness the chariots to the fastest horses, inhabitants of Lachish. She was the beginning of sin for the daughter of Zion. For the crimes of Israel are traceable to you. Therefore, you must bestow parting gifts upon Moresheth Gath. The houses of Achziv will disappoint the kings of Israel. Inhabitants of Marsha, I have yet to bring you the one who will invade and possess you. The glory of Israel will come to Adullam. Shave the hair from your head as you mourn for the children who were to your delight. Make yourselves as bald as vultures, for they have gone from you into exile. Verse 1 offers the all-important superscription. That is, verse 1 is not the beginning of the body of the prophetic message. Rather, it is there to explain who the author is, what the mood and tone of his work is going to be. Usually it includes a time reference, and overall context is presented to us to discern his intent. Now, the serious matter of a Bible book superscription is nearly always jumped over by Christian Bible commentators and pastors, assuming it is self-explanatory and nothing more needs to be said. See, thus typically, verse 1 is read, but the commentary or sermon on it doesn't begin until verse 2. Micah's superscription is this: this is the word of Yehovah that came to Micha, the Moshiti, during the days of Yotam, Achaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Shomron and Yerushalayim. I want to remind you all of something I've said in my teaching of other books, but I think it's significant enough to warrant the repetition. The whole of the Torah, and by extension, the entire Bible, has a superscription. that is never thought about as such. And because it isn't recognized for what it is just thought of as the beginning of the body of the scripture. That particular superscription is this, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, I hope you see how when we understand this is what it is, a superscription, then we get away from arguing over old earth, young earth, gap theories, and the like. The context for the book of Genesis, for the Torah, for the Hebrew Bible, for the New Testament, is set by that fundamental superscription. It tells us there was a beginning. The time frame for what we're going to hear about starts at that beginning. God was there at the time of the beginning. He is the one who created the heavens and the earth. All that follows it, all 66 books, is based upon that context supplied by that brief superscription, and therefore is the first and most important and foundational pillar of the Bible. That is the power, the importance of a superscription, including the one we find that begins the book of Micah. We must never just glide right by those as we come across them. Now, Micah's superscription commences by connecting Yehovah with the prophet Micah. That is, no one else was involved or present to receive this divine oracle. It was a personal and intimate interchange. That method of how prophecy is given to prophets is the standard biblical pattern, as we will not find any prophecy from God that is given to two or more people. It is always only to one person. The further claim contained within that superscription is that all that follows is the word of Yehovah. Okay, this is an important characterization in that the reader is alerted to the fact that whatever he finds in this book, it is the authentic word of God. The authenticity was especially important during the 8th century BC because there were scores, if not hundreds, of false prophets running around, all proclaiming messages of abundance and security. Yet do not misunderstand. The word of God doesn't necessarily mean the words of God. That is, it is not as though Micah was a courtroom reporter that merely wrote down every word God spoke to him and then repeated them verbatim in his book. Some words were, some weren't. The parts that were not Yehovah's direct words were then Micah's words. But as Yehovah's prophet, we are to take his words as being truthfully and accurately representative of the message he received. Micah was acting as God's personally authorized agent. Now, the importance of which prophet exactly is the authorized recipient of Yehovah's word is highlighted because of the inclusion of the extended identity of Micah as the Moreshite. Micah was not a unique name in Israelite society. Many men were named Micah. Moreshite means a resident of the town of Moresheth. So the prophet is further identified by means of connecting him to his hometown. We must also not overlook that Micah is a man, a male. None of the 12 minor prophets are females. Next, he's identified as prophesying during the reigns of the Judean kings Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So this gives us the historical time frame. Just as earlier in the introduction, I gave you a quick overview of the goings-on in the Middle East and in other parts of the world during Micah's day. So for the Israelites, by citing the kings that Micah served under, it delivered that same kind of historical information to Micah's readers for the next few hundred years, because the Jewish people knew the sorts of things that happened during the reigns of the different kings. A lot of it recorded in other books of the Tanakh, the Old Testament. And finally, that the superscription reveals that the main subjects of this prophecy would be Samaria and Jerusalem, the capitals of the two kingdoms. That is, both the northern and the southern kingdoms, all Israel, would be dealt with, although separately. And with that context now set, the main body of the prophetic message begins in verse 2. In verse 2, "Listen, peoples, all of you, pay attention, earth, and everything in it. Yehovah Elohim will witness against you, Adonai, from his holy temple." Okay. Verses 2 through 7 are a poetic opening to the book. Therefore, the emotion that poetry is meant to evoke is every bit as important as the message that it brings. So words to heighten the tension are used. The opening word is in Hebrew, Shema. It's an emphatic word. It means to listen or hear, that includes a response of action. To complete the poetic parallel, the Hebrew word to open the next stanza is kashab. It has a more literal meaning of incline your ear, to listen carefully. Who are the peoples that are to hear and respond? The Hebrew word used is amim, and it is often parallel in meaning to goyim, especially when used in poetry, and both terms mean nations. So this is God calling to all the nations and people groups on the planet to pay attention to what he is saying, since the judgment that he is going to announce concerning Israel is going to be the cause of a planetary-wide common experience of the greatest discomfort. And when he calls on the earth to pay attention, he means it as the planet itself, this big ball of dirt and water that we all live upon. That is, because this physical planet is the common home to all these peoples, and thus, again, poetically, it too cannot help but being involved and affected by what will happen. That is, the planet's geography and substance will be part of the consequences of the coming judgment. This fact is alluded to in other books of the Bible, but none so powerful as in Zechariah. In Zechariah 14, 3 and 4, "Then Yehovah will go out and fight against those nations, fighting as on a day of battle, and on that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which lies to the east of Jerusalem. And the Mount of Olives will be split in half from east to west to make a huge valley. Half of the mountain will move towards the north, half of it towards the south." To say that God is going to witness against them means he is going to bring accusations of wrongdoing for everyone. The Hebrew phrase of le'ed means be witness. But this is the technical language of a judicial trial. So the mental picture being formed is of God sitting in a courtroom to hold a hearing and render a verdict. The place he will bring this witness from is his holy temple. Does this mean God's heavenly holy temple? Or does it mean his temple in Jerusalem? Well, scholars typically choose one or the other as the correct meaning, each making good points in their arguments. However, I think there's an alternative. When we study the Torah rather thoroughly, we come to realize that God's cosmic temple in heaven, the structure of Mount Sinai, into three distinct areas where God came to give the Torah to Israel and to establish an everlasting covenant with him, and the design of the temple in Jerusalem are all the same, even serving essentially the same purpose. God judges from his heavenly temple. He judged from Mount Sinai, and he will judge from the place of his presence on earth, the temple in Jerusalem. So the meaning of holy temple in this verse is intentionally vague and meant to be inclusive of them all. Therefore, we need not be forced into distinguishing one from the other. We should merely understand it is the place from which Yahweh judges at different times in varying circumstances. Amidst all this, in the second verse, God is called by another title. The Complete Jewish Bible says Adonai Elohim. Other English versions say Lord God. None of these are correct. Rather, it is literally Adonai Yahweh, Lord Yahweh, a title of utmost respect that includes God's personal name. What this means is that the God named Yahweh that is calling the earth and everyone on it to judgment, it means he alone is the universal God that has the authority, the power to do so. He has no territorial boundaries, no association with other gods. He is sovereign over all people and all places. It is a declaration of absolute monotheism, even if the Hebrews didn't get that understanding, due to the beliefs among cultures that were ubiquitous in Bible times. Now, this is also bringing to us an image of God eventually coming to earth in a theophany. And all his awesome power and majesty, his arrival, will not only shatter peoples and nations, but the earth itself will convulse. And as we're soon to find out, it all has to do with Israel. He is coming to chastise sin, as well as to seek retribution on all those who have harmed his people. But first, the nations are to witness what happens to Israel, God's set-apart people who are being judged. Over and over in the Bible, Old and New Testaments, the common theme threads through it from beginning to end. All will be judged. But first, God's own people will be judged. God's people always mean all those who claim and rely upon his covenants. So, believers, that includes us. Nearly all prophetic books that allude to this say it will happen at some climactic end times event. Well, verse 3 continues with the same thought. For look, Yahweh is coming out of his place, coming down to tread on the high places of the land. Again, the concept of theophany, an actual appearance of God on earth, is being revealed. Therefore, the exclamatory term, hine, is the first word of the statement. Hine here means to behold, but it also adds the sense of immediacy, or in this case, suddenness. When God's arrival happens, it will be least expected by anyone, Israel or the nations. Ezekiel brings this to light, and we should not be remiss to include what he says as further information that provides a greater context for what we're reading here in Micah. In Ezekiel 38, starting in verse 1, the word of Yahweh came to me, human being, turn your face toward Gog of the land of Magog, chief prince of Meshech and Tuval, and prophesy against him. Say that Adonai Yahweh says, I'm against you, Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tuval. I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, and bring you out with all your army and horses and horsemen, all completely equipped. A great horde with breastplates and shields, all wielding swords. Paras, Ethiopian Put, are to be with them, all with breastplates and helmets. Gomer, with all its troops, the house of Toramah, and the far reaches of the north, with all its troops, many peoples are with you. Prepare yourself. Get ready, you and all your crowd gathered around you, and take charge of them. After many days have passed, you will be mustered for service. In later years, you will invade the land, which has been brought back from the sword, gathered out of many peoples, the mountains of Israel. They had been lying in ruins for a long time. But now Israel has been extracted from the peoples, and all of them are living there securely. But you will come up like a storm. You will be like a cloud covering the land, you and all your troops, many other peoples with you. Adonai Yahweh says, when that day comes, thoughts will well up in your mind, and you'll devise a sinister scheme, and you'll say, I'm going to invade this land of unwalled villages. I will take by surprise these people who are at peace, living securely, all in places without walls or bars or gates. I'll seize the spoil, take the plunder. You will attack the former ruins that are now inhabited. Come against the people gathered from the nations who have acquired livestock and other wealth and are living in the central parts of the land. See, notice the unexpected nature and the suddenness of what happens. This is why we must not overlook the important emphasis that is revealed in the word hine. Now, since we've been previously told that God judges from his holy temple, then verse 3, it means we are to picture him coming down from his holy temple, his heavenly holy temple, to earth, coming out of his high place in order to tread on the high places of the earth. Where are these high places? Well, the complete Jewish Bible wording implies the high places are in Israel. But the Hebrew grammar used more indicates the earth as a whole. High places are words that mean the locations where various peoples and their leaders place their shrines and altars and temples to worship their gods. We read of Asherahs, fir trees, planted on high places as symbolic of the fertility goddess. See, these high places could vary from natural hills to merely piled up earth to form a mound, or even to things such as engineering marbles like ziggurats of Nimrod's era. In the modern era, while these still exist, used in some places, more usual are opulent buildings, some with spires and obelisks. So this is just indicative of all the special places of worship, the false gods. Now, when we hear of God treading on these high places, it comes from the Hebrew derach. And this is a term used largely in a military context. It means to trample upon, to subjugate, to smash. And it's a violent, it's intentional. It carries a tone of incursion into enemy-held territory. It is God coming in his wrath, decimating those who are against him. Verse 4, beneath him the mountains will melt, the valleys split open like wax before fire, like water poured down from a steep slope. The imagery of God's arrival on earth continues with what happens to the earth itself. The earth swoons and sways beneath his immense weight. Yahweh comes like a superheated fire that melts mountains and causes their molten rock to flow like wax. And can we not see that such an image comes from volcanic eruptions and earthquakes? Continuing the poetic parallelism, the simile changes from melting like wax to flowing like water. Even nature is terrified at God's appearance. Mountains reducing to rubble, the opening of vast fissures in the ground, fire spewing out from the hilltops. This is, of course, the expected response. And what better way for people of any age to understand the unlimited, awesome power of Yahweh than what we're reading here? But then comes the cause of all that is happening. So let's pay close attention to this. Verse 5. All this is because of the crime of Jacob and the sins of the house of Israel. What's the crime of Jacob? Isn't it Shomron, Samaria? And what are the high places of Judah? Aren't they Jerusalem? See, all of this judgment and wrath and eruptions of nature are because of the crime of Jacob and the sins of the house of Israel. It is Yahweh reacting to this. That's the why of it all. As Peter said, the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God. The names Jacob, Yaakov, and Israel are synonymous terms. What this means is that where we read the crime of Jacob, it is but the first part of a poetic parallelism, with the second part being the sins of the house of Israel. The crime is the sins they commit, the offenses and transgressions against God's Torah. The entire nation, both kingdoms were guilty, so both would feel his wrath. To make this even clearer, the capital cities of the two kingdoms are named Samaria, Shomron, and Jerusalem, Yerushalayim. It is in the capital city, Samaria, especially, where the corruption is the greatest. Why name the capitals? Because they are representative of their entire nation. Because they are the center of government and of their perverse doctrines and religious leaders and pagan worship practices. It's little wonder that a most appropriate name for this first part of the book of Micah is the book of doom. Okay, we'll stop here for today and continue with this next time.